an apple for lunch today, you fat fuck. I liked that kid so much. I had real affection for him. He was a good guy with a wife and kid at home, and we had a lot of laughs. And for that reason, I purposely have not checked to see if he is still alive. I told him to look me up and call me if he ever needed anything. And I found that most guys I've met in the military, or the police, or fire department that I say that to, do call me at some point. It's been a few years, and it concerns me that I haven't heard from him, so I hope he's all right and that he knows I'm here if he ever needs me. It would affect me if I found out that he died, because even though it was only 10 days, it seemed like an eternity. We were friends by the end, and it would really suck to hear that he had died over there. Those guys see a friend die, most of the time, right next to them, and they have to keep moving. A lot of times they have to leave them where they fall, because if they don't, it will cost more lives. Maybe even their own. I wanted to give the troops a great show, so when I was invited by the USO, I purposely chose 3 guys who were hard to follow, knowing that I would be closing every night. Dave, Nick, and Jim are headliners, all famous for destroying, and everybody killed every show. In 10 days, nobody had a bad set. Attell set the tone on the very first night. We were told that we couldn't do jokes about the commander-in-chief, who at the time was George W. Bush. That wasn't going to be a problem, because there was not a liberal pussy among us. The other rule was no masturbation jokes. I guess masturbating is an epidemic over there. Don't rile them up, is what the USO officer told us. Here's how Dave Attell opened his set and our tour. "Listen," he said, "they told us that we can't talk about masturbating with you. They said it was a rule, and I'm not going to break it. I'm a good citizen, and I support our troops in every way, so I will adhere to that rule and won't do any jokes about masturbating. What I would like to do is open up with a story about the time I was fucking a sock filled with shampoo." He got a 5-minute standing ovation, but you should have seen the look on the face of the Marine in charge of our safety. He was standing stone still, shaking his head as if to say, "You motherfucker." I'd like to think I'd be the guy to do that, but I'm not. Dave Attell is. To me, that would be too much of a risk. Because it wasn't the club owner at the St. Louis Chuckle Hut laying down the law. It was the U.S. fucking Army. Anyway, by the end of our tour, we had done all the shows that were scheduled when the USO officer in charge told us that there was one last base where we could perform. It hadn't been mentioned when the trip was set up because the USO had never arranged for any entertainers to visit it. The location was classified, deep in a remote region of Afghanistan, and all the troops stationed there were running black ops. It was off-limits for A-listers like Billy Crystal because of the danger, but I guess we were special, by which I mean C-list. They told us it was very bare bones, so not to expect much, but they'd have a makeshift stage. They asked us to shorten our sets to about 10 minutes and then spend the rest of the time just hanging out and talking with the guys for a while. I immediately agreed because I was happy to give them a break from their lives any way I could. They asked me to go because I'm single with no kids. Low risk. I actually chose Attell and Florentine for the tour because neither of them have kids. If a tour I booked left a friend's kids fatherless, I'd never be able to live with myself. I tried to keep Gary Delabate from coming on the trip at all because he's got a family, but he persisted until I eventually caved and let him be our MC. That was fine, but I still think it was stupid for him to visit that black ops base. He actually said he was going to hang back, and then at the last minute, he got on the second helicopter, that motherfucker. I got into an argument with him when we arrived, because to me, he was risking his life for what? A story to tell Howard on the air? We flew over the Afghan desert in a Black Hawk helicopter escorted by 2 Apaches, and we saw the caves and little foxholes in the sand where the Taliban live. The ground below would look like smooth sand, and then they'd just emerge from these holes with their wives and kids. It was completely insane. We also flew right over the ruins of Alexander the Great's castle, which was amazing to see. We got there in the afternoon and waited because the guys were delayed returning from an operation, and one of them wasn't coming back. I asked if we should just cancel since they'd lost a soldier, but the troops didn't want that. They told their superiors that they needed to laugh now more than ever. There were chairs for about 20 guys, and 8 of them decided to come see the show while the others got some rest. Those 8 came in covered in dirt, and some looked like they'd been crying. They threw down their bulletproof vests and gear, slumped in their chairs, and stared at the stage with expressions unlike any I've ever seen in my life. They were looking for something, anything to transport them back home for a few minutes. All of us went pretty low-key with our acts because the laughter threshold was at a minimum. Killing in that crowd was a chuckle, or one of them holding their gut and half laughing, looking like they were in pain. We adjusted, and we did our thing, and when we finished, the amount of affection they showed us was unbelievable. We got so many sincere hugs. One of them said it best when he said, "We're all hurting a lot right now, but you were so funny that laughter really helped us out." I didn't think it would, but it did. They told us about the friend they'd lost that day, his name, where he was from, and stories about him. A few started crying, and it was really rough. But I'm glad we were there with them. We signed autographs, we shared a meal together, and then they had to get to sleep because they had to get back at it the next day. During the return flight in the Black Hawk, I was allowed to shoot the huge gun mounted in the helicopter. The soldier who let me do it was a bit of a redneck. "Artie, you want to shoot this fucker? You ain't never gonna get your hands on one of these again." "Yeah, sure," I said. "But is there anyone out there? What if I actually kill some Taliban guy?" "Shit, Artie, I hope you do. That will be one less I have to kill." Good thing I never wanted to be a sharpshooter, because there was a mountain directly in front of us, and I couldn't hit it. I held off on telling my mother about any of this, because she didn't even want me to go fishing when I was a longshoreman, because she thought that I'd fall overboard and drown. This was a few clicks past fishing, but there was no way I was sitting that one out. I had to do what I could for guys who were gambling with their lives at the high-stakes tables. What is their risk for, by the way? All we've done being over there is make things worse. There is a haunting piece of footage of George H.W. Bush during the first Gulf War talking about whether we should go all the way and take out Saddam Hussein. He says that we've taken the city, we've secured the oil we wanted, and that everything was under control.
"If we take him out," he says, "what then?"
It's too bad that thought never crossed the mind of his dumb, Bible-thumping son.
Tell you what, we're finding out what then is right now. In Afghanistan, we created ISIS. And there is no bigger irony in the world. No matter how much we spend and how many troops we send, we can't keep the place stable. We destroyed their capital and can't rebuild it fast enough. Their kids are starving, and now they hate us, and you can't blame them for that. We can't protect them from the Syrian rebels who come in and organize all that hatred. They gather people in town squares and make speeches and pass out literature to focus that fury. The outrage festered, and a decade later, ISIS emerged. The "what then" Bush Sr. was worried about became ISIS. They detest us so much that ISIS has people signing up willing to die just to kill some of us and disturb our way of life. That's hatred on a level we do not understand here. I mean, I hate the Mets, but I wouldn't blow myself up to kill David Wright. What I'm getting at is that when I look at the mess in Afghanistan, I see gamblers and risk-takers on both sides. I see our troops risking their lives to protect our country and our way of life, and I see terrorists who are gambling big. When they play the right hand with a nothing bet, they can seriously disturb life in the nations they consider their enemies. I hate to say it, But if you can motivate people to kill themselves to hurt the opposition, your strategy is working. Listen, I hate the Kardashians, but I'm not willing to kill myself to blow up Caitlyn Jenner. Actually, you know what? If I could get a guarantee that Scott Disick would die, I'd be willing to die. That's how strong my hatred of the Kardashians is. And what then? For my sacrifice, I hope someone would erect a statue of me, preferably on the beach in front of the Delano Hotel in Miami, to honor the fact that I prevented Scott Disick from procreating again. Chapter 16. Some risks are too great. The greatest actor I've ever worked with, hands down, is Laurie Metcalf. The multiple Emmy winner is known for her roles on Roseanne, The Big Bang Theory, Toy Story, and more. She is an original member of Chicago's famous Steppenwolf Theater Company, along with talents like John Malkovich and Gary Sinise. She was also Norm's co-star on Norm, and I was lucky enough to have had many scenes with her during the two seasons I was on. On the show, her character hated mine and would get annoyed and hit me, so all I had to do was stand there and let Laurie be funny. She was hilarious, the perfect combination of timing, delivery, and physical comedy. Meanwhile, everyone thought I was being funny. People would tell me that I was hysterical, and I'd say thanks and take the compliment, but it was all Laurie. I need to thank her because her acting definitely got me laid a couple of times for my work on Norm. She's an amazing person, and she and I became great friends working on that show. Laurie also played my mother in Beer League, which was an enormous favor. During the summer break between the second and what would be the final season of Norm, Laurie took a trip to the East Coast with her oldest daughter Zoe to look at colleges. I wasn't on Stern yet, but I already knew Gary Delabate well, so I was able to get Zoe a summer internship there. Laurie was very grateful for that and asked me to go to lunch with the two of them to thank me. At the time, John C. Reilly and Philip Seymour Hoffman were doing the play True West at the Circle in the Square Theater on Broadway. Laurie had front row tickets because of her Steppenwolf pedigree, so we planned to see it after lunch and go backstage to say hello to Reilly and Hoffman. The show was incredible. The play is about two brothers, and those two amazing actors would do two performances a day and switch roles for the second one. They'd do a matinee as one character and then play the other character in the evening. There is only one other character in the play, their mother, which Laurie played in a production of it when she was in her 20s, wearing makeup so that she'd appear to be an old woman. So she had a special attachment to True West. When the curtain came down, we went backstage, and Laurie and her daughter caught up with John C. Reilly because they're friends. Philip Seymour Hoffman was there, too, so he and I started talking. "Wow," I said. "The show was really amazing, man. I can't believe you do two of those a day and change roles." He was very down to earth, very humble, friendly, and reserved. After a while, Reilly left with his girl, and Laurie and her daughter got ready to head out. Hoffman and I were the only ones with no plans. "What are you doing right now?" he asked me. "Nothing at all," I said. "You want to get a steak with me?" "Yeah, sure." We went to a steakhouse nearby, I don't remember which one, and hung out for the next 2 hours. He was everything people say he was. Thoughtful, intelligent, well-read. He hadn't won the Oscar yet. Capote was coming out the next year. But he was so clearly gifted, it was a privilege to spend casual time like that with him. He talked about acting the way great musicians talk about music, both aware and in awe of it. At the beginning of lunch, everything was great, but as the meal went on, I could see that he was sweating more than anyone should have been in that air-conditioned restaurant. By the end, he was in a rush to leave. I wasn't familiar with the symptoms then, but I sure am now. He had to get to his hotel room to get high and fend off the withdrawals so he could do the second performance. When Philip Seymour Hoffman died, they found 70 bags of heroin and a pile of needles in the room. That's how much you buy when you want to be sure you have enough to keep withdrawals at bay, and that
is a living hell. If you're traveling, you must be sure that at the other end of the plane ride, you either have some waiting or know where to get it, because if you don't, sheer panic sets in. It makes every single detail of flying a waking nightmare. And that's how it is if your plane leaves on time. If you're grounded by weather in an unfamiliar city, forget it. There isn't a first-class lounge in the world that has what you need on their list of amenities. It would be great if they did. Welcome to American Airlines Platinum Lounge. We have massages, manicures, China White, cocktails, and dinner from 5 a.m. to 10 p.m. daily. Withdrawals are hell. I can't even imagine the anxiety Hoffman must have experienced doing that play. I've done stand-up routines in full-blown withdrawals, which I've come to affectionately refer to as my withdrawal sets. I'll never forget one that took place in Orlando, Florida. I was contracted to do an hour set for $60,000, and half an hour in, I realized I wasn't going to make it. I continued my act while trying to figure out how long I had until the uncontrollable diarrhea began. After the profuse sweating begins, the next phase is uncontrollable diarrhea. If I shit my pants on stage, I wondered, is that worse than leaving the stage early? It was a gamble, but I decided to keep going, and I nearly made it, too. The very moment I left the stage, I started to shit my pants. If I'd been wearing a diaper, it would have been full by the time I got to the dressing room door. But I wasn't, so the shit just ran down my leg. As I often did in those days, I told my former assistant, Teddy, to get me new pants. By then, he'd stopped asking why and had learned to find pants wherever we happened to be. If you ever find yourself applying for a job as my assistant, know now that ability to find pants anywhere is a prerequisite for consideration. When I spent that afternoon with Philip Seymour Hoffman, I tried opiates once or twice, but never often enough to get hooked. Everyone's tolerance is different, but the commonly held rule of thumb is that you need to do them for about 4 days straight to become physically addicted, and I'd always pulled up short of that. After I crossed that line and got in too deep, I often replayed that lunch in my mind, seeing details of his behavior for what they really were. Even with that knowledge and knowing how it ended for him, I still went for it. I needed more risk in my life at the time, and opiates are one hell of a way to put everything that matters to you at risk in one shot. The morning after Hoffman died in 2014, both the Post and the Daily News ran pictures of him looking terrible. Hair disheveled, unshaven, clothes a mess. I was headlining Caroline's that night, and here's how I opened. "Guys," I said, "for once I didn't need a mirror this morning. You know why?" I held the Post up next to my face, and the place went nuts. It was the biggest laugh I got all night. One that went right into a collective groan because it was the darkest laugh ever. Then a drunk guy in the front yelled, "Faggot!" Which, if you've ever been to Caroline's on a Friday, is pretty typical. Whenever I struggle with heroin, I think of that lunch. I also think of the time back in 1998 that Mitch Hedberg, Greg Giraldo, and I played the Comedy Cellar and then went to the Chelsea Square restaurant on 9th Avenue and 23rd Street and talked until 7 a.m. If you took a picture of that table and had to choose the two guys who wouldn't be alive 15 years later, I'm pretty sure I would have been one of them. It amazes me that I'm still here. That night, we talked about everything. And you bet your life we talked about dope. Mitch told us, as he told Dave Attell and other close friends of his, that he knew exactly what he was doing and knew how it would end. "Guys, don't try to stop me," he said. "I love you for it and thanks for caring, but I'm doing heroin until the day I die. I'm going to shoot heroin every day until that happens, and nothing is going to stop me. Even if I get busted, I won't stop. I hear you can get it in jail pretty easy, so I'll just keep doing it there." He bought a big Winnebago by that point, so he wouldn't have to fly as much, and eventually that is where he and his wife lived full-time.
He stopped flying altogether after he was stopped by customs officers and arrested because of a strange odor coming from him, which was gangrene. He'd shot up between his toes so much that his foot was rotting and was in such bad shape that he had to get half of it amputated. 2 weeks later, he died. He limped into the Stern Show studio the last day I saw him. Greg Giraldo's demons might have been worse than Hedberg's, believe it or not. He wasn't shooting junk, but he was a self-fulfilling prophecy, because he thought it was rock and roll to do a lot of drugs. He also used to proudly say that comics were the new rock stars. "All music sucks now," he'd say. "There are no new rock stars. Comics are the new rock stars. We are like AC/DC in Boston." "Whatever, man," I used to say. "Now if that ain't the dope talking." But he made an interesting point. When we were growing up, there were rock stars. But after Kurt Cobain, there really weren't any anymore. Some of the hip-hop guys filled the void, and guys like Eminem are great storytellers. He's like a hip-hop Springsteen, in my opinion. But they're few and far between. The last time I cared about buying music was in the mid-90s. I remember going to buy In Utero the day it came out. After Cobain died in 1994, there was a shift, and I do think comedians filled that void. My generation of comics, Hedberg, Attell, me, Louis C.K., Dave Chappelle, Greer Barnes, and a few others, we tell stories, we reflect our times, and we push the envelope. And all of us got our big breaks right around the time Kurt Cobain died. I landed on Mad TV in 95, Attell hit that same year, and Hedberg hit big in 97. By the time showbiz caught up to his genius, he was already burned out, however. When Comedy Central finally gave him a one-hour special, he tanked. It wasn't his fault, because the jokes were hilarious, but the audience sucked. If you watch it, you'll see Mitch telling amazing jokes, and the audience sitting there confused because they don't get it. It's an important piece of history, because to me, that moment was the start of the politically correct millennial bullshit that has stalled the evolution of stand-up comedy. Younger comics just don't take risks. The only upside of it all is that people like me, who aren't afraid to go there in their material, are outlaws. And show me a time in history when outlaws haven't been popular. I'm lucky to have found my forum before all of that happened. I was able to do politically incorrect humor on a national level every morning for 8 years behind a superstar radio host. Jeff Ross always says that the roasts he's now famous for were his Yankee Stadium. Dave Attell says his show Insomniac was his Yankee Stadium. Howard was mine. A good thing, because Howard's show today is the perfect example of how political correctness has ruined comedy. His show is so unbelievably safe, boring, and just bad. It's amazing how sensitive people are today, and in being so, more narrow-minded, all under the guise of being more open-minded and accepting. They're accepting of what they think is acceptable, which is the exact opposite of being truly accepting and open-minded. What I have come to accept is that there is one thing I wish I could undo in my life. I'm not one to look at the past with regret. Even if you haven't read my other books, by this point you should realize that my ups and downs are who I am, so I couldn't change much. Except for heroin. That changed everything for me. It was the bet I wish I'd never placed. The one chaotic demon I wish I hadn't invited into my life. It's the one high I wish I'd never known. Because it's the one you never quite capture again, but spend the rest of your life chasing. It is a cheap shortcut to the kind of excitement I like. And one I wish I'd never discovered, because if you ask me, there are so many more rewarding ways to make your life unstable, like quitting a well-paying job to become a comic. Opiate addicts are not like other people. There are more than 30 million opiate abusers worldwide, with about 2.1 million here in the United States, half a million of which are heroin abusers. Certain people, who may or may not have tastes for other drugs, are simply wired for opiates, and once they try them, that's a wrap. And it's not just people whose lives are being devastated by them. It's parrots, too. In places like Neemuch, India, poppy farmers have reported that a growing percentage of the parrot population in the area is addicted, and the parrots have been plundering their fields to satisfy their cravings. The birds wait until March and April when workers split open the flower pods, allowing them to ripen in the sun and produce morphine. The parrots will swoop down in silence, nibble the stalks just below the pod, then retreat to the high branches of a tree to enjoy their prize. These parrots have learned not to squawk or attract any attention while they make off with the flower pods. They will gorge on the poppy up in the treetops, then sleep for hours. Some of them get so high that they nod off and fall to their deaths. It's the equivalent of falling asleep on the couch with a lit cigarette, which can be lethal if you don't live with someone like my podcast producer and roommate, Dan Filato, who is handy with a fire extinguisher. This phenomenon was first reported a few years ago, by a parrot, I imagine, and it has become worse with each passing year. The farmers are losing about 10% of their crop to these junky birds, which is a problem because poppy farming is regulated by the Indian government, and the farmers aren't making their quotas. If anyone wants to buy me a birthday present, by the way, I'll take a one-way ticket to Neemuch for spring break. And don't worry about getting me the international roaming plan, because I won't be needing my phone. Anyway, the news reports I've read focus on the farmers in this situation, but what they're neglecting is the plight of the parrots. I've done some of my own research and found an interview with a Neemuch parrot who claims that once he got hooked on the poppy, he started to hate Jimmy Buffett. His friends reported that he started playing guitar around that time and that he learned the solo from Gimme Shelter in under 10 minutes. The parrots that eat poppy also seem to enjoy Charlie Parker more than the parrots who don't. There are also the parrots who avoid the poppy and look on as their friends and neighbors dive down into the fields for their fix. They sit on branches beside them as the druggy birds nod off, and they watch some of them die, either from predators they are too high to avoid or by falling to their deaths. I'm no ornithologist, but it seems to me that the parrots who stay off the pop see the risk and choose to avoid it, despite how much better their friends are at guitar. I'm sure it's tempting, but those parrots don't want to end up sucking cock for poppy, and I can't blame them. My point is that even animals can recognize opiate risk, but somehow, at 50 years old, I can't. And that's because I'm a risk addict. Just look at me, still getting arrested for heroin and cocaine possession at my age, this latest time in the parking garage of my apartment building. How pathetic is that? I forgot my keys and got locked out of my apartment. Dan was away, and I had an hour to kill before a locksmith could show up. I'd just come back from picking up a significant amount of drugs, because there's nothing worse than running out, so it was all there. But my point is this. Rather than wait in the lobby of my building, or even in one of the many restaurants near my house, I decided to wait in my car, in my garage, and get high. It was stupid, because looking the way I usually do, which is somewhere just north of Vagrancy, one of my neighbors assumed that I had broken into my Range Rover and called the cops. They didn't think it could be mine. They thought I was in there sleeping or shitting. I was doing both, actually, and legally, because it was my car. Anyway, I was arrested, and my love of opiates put all that I had going for me in danger once again. The only upside when something like that happens is that, while some call it tragic, Anthony and I call it a chapter. If I could go back to the 90s when I was on blow and my life was chaotic, I would. You can stop snorting blow if you want to. You can stop smoking weed. But heroin and opiates of any kind become a part of you. They become your oxygen. You might think you're invincible, but play around with them and in no time you'll have a serious habit to the point that you'll need them every 8 hours. That's what these poor parrots don't understand.
If I could speak parrot, I'd tell them that one day they're going to come back to the field and the poppies will be gone. There will be panic in Parrot Park. I'd ask them, what the fuck will Polly do then? Whether you're a bird or a person, withdrawals are horrible. But I'm not sure anyone into opiates thinks it's that bad until it happens to them. If I were a farmer in Nemuch, I'd try to make that point to those poppy-eating parrots. Since language would be an issue, I'd probably organize a screening of Sugar Hill for them, which is a pretty bad movie from 1993, aside from how well Clarence Williams III, star of the hit 70s TV show The Mod Squad, recreates withdrawals. He has a scene where he gets a hot shot, which is a deliberately lethal dose of heroin from his son, who is a heroin dealer, and dies. But before he ties himself off for the last time, he gives a speech about the first time he did heroin. He's in full withdrawal, sweating, and it's so convincing that I can barely watch it. Seems to me that Clarence might have had some real-life experience, if you know what I mean. Anyway, his character tells his son that if he's selling, he can never start using because it will never let him go. Then he tells a story and delivers a line that would be cheesy coming from a lesser actor. I was on my way to church, and my dealer stopped me and said, "Son, where are you going? This is your God." He pulled that line off. Black people can do that with language. Think of a white guy doing that line. It would be terrible. Quincy Jones used to call me a funny cat. That was cool as hell coming from him. If someone like Ryan Seacrest said that to me, I'd want to hit him with a fungo bat. Heroin is the ultimate risk. And being the loser I am, I had to try it. I survived cocaine, pills, and gambling. And I made it through my crazy youth and early career in show business. And when the smoke cleared, I was on Stern and earning $100,000 a weekend doing stand-up. I'd gotten my dream job, telling stories about my friends and me as kids and getting laughs and being paid for it. I did imitations of a cartoon rooster, of Foghorn Leghorn on the radio for millions of people. Back in high school, when I'd get in trouble for disrupting class doing that imitation, I was told that I'd never use that skill. Well, I did, Mr. Mafucci. Just thought you'd like to know. Clearly being on Stern was the only job I was ever cut out to do. But I needed to fuck that up. I like getting high, and I'd done every drug except heroin. How could I resist? That one came with the risk of getting hooked pretty quickly. I decided to try it once, and if I could go back to that night in that hotel room, I'd tackle myself. I snorted some China White, and to this day I've never had anything so pure in my life again. It might have just seemed that way because it was my first hit, but I don't think so. I tell this story in my first book, but I will never forget what happened after I did those first two lines. It was around 3 a.m., and I lay back on the bed and said aloud, before my head hit the pillow, "I'm in trouble." I still am. I've chased that high ever since, all the way into my garage not long ago. It has not been worth it. But when you're an opiate addict, you don't realize that until it's too late. I'm going to get serious here for a minute because the opiate epidemic in this country has reached outrageous proportions. More than 50,000 people died of drug overdoses in 2015, which is higher than auto accidents, and for the first time in U.S. history, more than those killed by gun violence. And it's only getting worse. This didn't happen overnight. It happened because opioid prescriptions have tripled since 1990, jumping from 76 million to 219 million prescriptions for painkillers written by doctors in 2011. That's insane. All those people can't always get pills, so what has also increased is the demand for heroin, which is cheaper than pills if you're buying on the street. What we've seen as a result is a massive increase in heroin production in Mexico and South America and more lethal overdoses in younger age groups across all races than ever before.
Actually, whites and Native Americans lead the charge there, but according to a report in the New York Times, that's because doctors are more reluctant to prescribe painkillers to minority patients because they're worried they might sell them or become addicted. I'm getting all these facts from an in-depth report by Frontline, which airs on PBS, by the way. This isn't fake news. I bring this up because there is only one way to turn this disaster around, and it's a difficult one because there is money involved. All of this happened because doctors started overprescribing. And why did that happen? Because they get kickbacks from the pharmaceutical companies. They get free trips, they get to have free dinners with the smoking hot drug reps who come to their offices to drop off the newest pills, then they write scripts for those pills, and eventually end up with yachts. Doctors need to stop that bullshit and start being honest with their patients, especially their youngest ones. Say you're a 17 or 18-year-old kid who comes in with an injury. Maybe the kid has seen Artie Lang do an offensive joke on YouTube while he was home in his safe space, and ever since, he's had trouble breathing because his heart is bruised by what he saw. Or let's say a kid hurts his elbow while playing football. What doctors have been saying too often in the past 20 years is, your elbow hurts, take some OxyContin and get some rest. The doctor equates fixing the pain with fixing the situation. The kid gets a bottle of 15 OxyContin, and he takes them, and he feels pretty damn good because the injury isn't that bad in the first place. So when the bottle is empty, he wants another. When you're exposed to substances, opiates especially, before your mid-20s, there is a statistically greater chance that you will become addicted. So our kid with the hurt elbow goes through his bottle of 15 pills, and even though the injury isn't bothering him anymore, he tells his parents and his doctor that it is, because he wants to keep getting high. The doctor has given him 2 refills, so he gets one and finishes it in half the time because he's doubling up and enjoying himself, but by the time he gets through that second bottle, he's physically addicted. For most people, this is where their lives go off the rails. This is a common scenario that puts kids out of commission for at least a little while, if not permanently. Our guy's hopes of being on the football team for the rest of the season are over, as is wanting to get out of bed in the morning. He's in withdrawals at 17, not knowing what the fuck is going on. If his parents know nothing about drugs, they'll just think he's sick. So they get him his last refill, which he goes through in just a few days because he's tripling up now, and the doctor won't give him another refill because that would be bad doctoring and could cost him his medical license. Or maybe he's unavailable because he's yachting. There's nothing funny about this, because it's par for the course in our country these days. In the past 20 years, doctors have become drug dealers, especially when it comes to kids. If a 17-year-old gets a sports injury, chances are it will be better in a few days at most, because the kid is 17. Instead, the injury is replaced with a desire for something that the kid didn't even know existed just a short time before. Once the kid has the taste, he will never lose it. He'll be at a high school party with his dick-lick friends, and he'll ask around. He'll be able to tell who has the pills on them, believe me. They will be drug dealers, who may be white with long hair, or fellows of a darker complexion, and the drug users will be even easier to find because they will look like me. They'll probably have something on their shirt that is either drool, throw up, a cookie, or a leftover piece of OxyContin. It's rare, but one of them might even have a chronically bleeding nose from the time last month when he accidentally snorted Oxy mixed with glass. In any case, this kid's football injury has transformed him into a statistic in no time. He's now one more kid who needs to be detoxed, all because of a hurt elbow. It simply wasn't like that not long ago. That could never have happened to me at 17 because there was only weed and blow going around when I was a kid, never opiates or other prescription drugs. If that had happened to me at 17, I'd be dead. I meet kids in my NA and AA meetings all the time that look at me and think, I've somehow made it through life successfully as a junkie. That could not be further from the truth.
and I make sure to let them know. I wasn't a teenage junkie. I made my bones in the business before I got into it. I started in my mid-30s, when I had money. These poor kids nowadays, I really feel for them because they are going through some horrible shit. I went to an AA meeting in Pittsburgh that was single-handedly the most depressing gathering I've ever been to in my life. This was after the zipper nose incident, by the way, so I was already feeling pretty terrible and looking even worse. But I came off more composed than George Clooney compared to these kids. At the end of the meeting, they were hugging me, saying that I inspired them, and that if I could have made it to where I am in life being a junkie, then they could succeed too. If you can do it, we can do it, they kept saying. No, I'd say, you don't understand. I'm not doing it. This is not what it looks like when you're doing it. Those kids I met were in a horrific place. Most of them were going home as junkies to a house where their parents were junkies too. Nearly all of them told similar stories about their parents stealing their drugs and leaving them to suffer the withdrawals. How awful is that? A family like that will eventually kill each other, be institutionalized, or be killed by other people. I can't think of a more desperate, hopeless situation. I've been in withdrawals that were so bad that if I weren't handcuffed to a bed with someone watching me and caring for me, I would have killed myself by jumping off the balcony the second I got loose. Since I've been a junkie, I've always had money, so unlike Robert Downey Jr.'s character in Less Than Zero, I've never had to blow a guy for drugs. But then again, Dan Filato never asked. We have had the following conversation, however. Dan, just drive to Washington Heights and pick up the envelope. I can't. I'm reading the Architectural Digest. What if I blow you? Dan might act like that little chat hasn't happened, but it has. It's better for both of us that he refused, but I'd like Dan and everyone else to think about how much worse it would be if I were in one of those junkie families. If I were, my father and I might both be blowing Dan for heroin, maybe even at the same time. Anyway, doctors have been administering prescription pills with the discrimination of a Pez dispenser for the past 20 years. And now we have ghettos of drug addicts in the suburbs of cities like Pittsburgh and Philadelphia. Drugs used to be an inner-city problem, but now it's a suburban one thanks to the pharmaceutical companies and the doctors. Think about it. When cocaine was king, drug dealers used to look like Robert Loggia in Scarface. They had money and class, and even in the inner cities, they were pimps who drove Cadillacs. Now they're all white trash kids with mullets who cook meth when times get tough. They look like Michael Anthony, the bass player for Van Halen, but with half a nose because it's been blown off in a meth lab explosion. They're chubby rednecks with access to a shack where they occasionally make terrible meth and never clean the spackle buckets. And don't get me started on synthetic weed and all the other shit people are turning to because they're desperate once they lose access to the pills that got them hooked. That shit, whatever it is, needs to be stopped right away. It's turning people into zombies. Remember that one guy in Florida who was high on that garbage and bit someone's face off? And the guy who barreled through Times Square in his car, taking out crowds of people because he was high on it and heard voices? It's almost as if a foreign nation is waging chemical warfare on our population with that stuff. Thank goodness synthetic weed is produced in China, a country that has our best interests in mind. What I'm getting at here is that doctors might be the only people who can turn this epidemic around. They need to focus on prevention rather than acting as the gateway to addiction. They have to nip this in the bud and be the vaccine for this disease. And here's how. There should be some sort of regulation and instruction that they get from the government out of the gate, plus repercussions if they prescribe pills to teenagers who don't need them. But most importantly, they need to take the time to talk to these kids and not be lazy and just give them a pill for the pain. No matter how hot the chick from Pfizer is, they need to sit the injured kids down and let them know what could happen.
Doctors with shitty bedside manner can always just appeal to their macho.
Listen, Rocco, I know your elbow hurts, but I need to ask you something.
Okay, Doc.
You seem like a tough kid. You hurt your elbow. You gotta tell me seriously how much it hurts. Sit and think about it. Can you get through tonight? Can you get through a bit of tomorrow, the way it hurts right now?
I guess so. Yeah, I guess I could.
I think you can. If you tell me you can't, I'm your doctor. I've got to help you out and give you a pill. And I will do that, but first I'd like to show you a short film about what could happen. It's called Don't Be Artie Lang. If they don't like my humor, the doctor or even a nurse could read them an article about Mike Webster, the famous Super Bowl and all-pro Pittsburgh Steeler, who spent his post-football life hooked on drugs to deal with a multitude of symptoms, and was dead by 50. After that, I'm sure the kid will tough it out. And maybe the doctor won't get laid by the girl from Pfizer, but you know what? She wasn't going to fuck the doctor anyway. She was going home to her gym trainer husband the whole time. Put it this way. If she looked like Christy Brinkley, the doctor was only ever going to get some version of Christy's daughter, who looks like Billy Joel on the cover of The Stranger, by the way. I know this sounds goofy and corny, but it's really simple. We have to be human beings watching out for each other, and it needs to start on the front lines with the doctors. They need a code of ethics when it comes to this stuff. And that, in my humble junkie opinion, is what needs to happen. That will help reverse the pill issue, which will, in turn, reverse the heroin problem. Those kids who can no longer afford the pills turn to Mexican Brown, because it's so fucking cheap. I'm not using any proven frame of reference. But having a baggie delivered from Paterson, New Jersey, to, say, North Hoboken, costs about $18. Again, I'm guesstimating. It's really sad that a chemical can bond you and become a lure and a trigger for the rest of your life. A lure so strong that even parrots can't resist it. Yet still, even in the avian world, there are those who have sense, who aren't degenerates. They're the ones who say, "Fuck that. Polly go to DeVry. Polly go to DeVry. Polly go sell bras and girdles. Polly sell bras and girdles." They don't say, "Polly get high and go to an open mic." I'm one of the idiots. I'm one of the people who thought taking huge risks made you cool. It really doesn't. That's the reason why I'm not the king of Queens. Well, not the only reason. Leah Remini hated me. My point is that I've seen certain people whom I know are less talented shoot past me on the career track. Maybe I'm wrong. My mother thinks I'm more talented than the people I'm thinking of, and that's very nice of her. I tend to agree with her when she says things like that. But none of that matters anymore. By taking the biggest risk I could, the one that made me cool, I paid the price. I couldn't get up early enough to make the auditions for High Fidelity and School of Rock. Somebody who was chubby did get up on time and made those auditions. One of us was an all-county baseball player in his day. One of us was not. None of that matters anymore. But while we're on the subject, I was also on heroin when the auditions were held for the role of the retard in There's Something About Mary. It's too bad, because I do a great retard. I do a high-functioning one every day, in fact. Listen, the point I'm trying to make, besides the doctors and the parrots, is that my ultimate risk cost me. I know that all my losses come back to the fact that I bet I could beat addiction. I lost that bet. Trying out dope and getting hooked and chasing it ever since has characterized my life since my late 30s, and it hasn't been glamorous or fun. There are only two good things that have come out of it, which is why I'm writing this chapter at all. One, helping kids to not do as I've done, and two, about $300,000 from my publisher. Chapter 17. If you hit, you play.
Uncle Artie was visited by an angel recently. The angel didn't have wings, wasn't white as the driven snow, and I'm not setting up a joke that involves someone Hispanic named Angel. That does remind me of a joke, though. Isn't it great when somebody tells you that Jesus loves you? His love knows no bounds. He loves you no matter what you've done. That's great to hear, unless you're in a Mexican prison. My angel was a bit different. He was a member of the LAPD, which is a miracle, considering my past relationship with the LAPD, specifically the time I threw a wild haymaker at an officer after a foot race that started on the NBC lot, continued through a grocery store, and ended in the middle of a busy intersection. I had a giant bag of Coke in my pocket when they caught me, which didn't help matters. I should have stashed that in aisle 3. Anyway, I was in L.A. for the premiere of Crashing, which was an exciting week. There was press and stand-up to do, and we screened the show and had a party at Avalon. I was so nervous that I left the screening early and went back to my hotel because I couldn't even watch it. Let's face it, the offers for featured roles on an HBO series aren't exactly rolling in, so I was worried sick that I'd done a terrible job and was about to bomb, never to be considered for TV again. This made sense considering how I'd prepared for shooting those episodes, running white lines with a sexy Southie. So I left and sat alone in my hotel, a nervous wreck, until my sister called me to say that the show was great and that I'd done really well and that I should come and enjoy the party. I was happy to hear that, but I still wasn't going back. She's my sister, I thought. Of course she's going to say that I did well. Finally, Jimmy Kimmel called and told me to stop being ridiculous, that I'd killed and that everyone there wanted to see me. So I went back to Avalon, and Gina Gershon gave me a huge hug, and everyone I saw said that I'd done a great job. I took everyone's words with a grain of salt until I finally watched the premiere and the entire season a few days later. All I can say is that Judd Apatow is truly a genius, because he knew what to do with me. He knows how to get the best out of people, and he really knows how to work with stand-ups, which isn't easy. Judd got a great performance out of Dave Attell, Greer Barnes, and everybody else from my world who appeared in season one. What I did on Crashing is the best work I've ever done on television, and I'm honored to be a part of it. And I have Judd to thank for it. To coincide with the Crashing promo tour, Pete Holmes, Judd, and I also did stand-up gigs. The plan was for me to close each show, after Judd and Pete, and in New York, after Dave Attell. Judd and Pete attract a real alternative comedy crowd, which is a bit of a challenge for someone like me. And following Dave Attell, the greatest comic alive, is an incredibly tough test that I was looking forward to. Dave is my friend, but I told him not to hold back because this was a big spot for him, too. He destroyed, and then I went up and killed for an hour, which is not easy to do, but it happened. In my business, it's the equivalent of pulling a rabbit out of a hat, which is easier to do if your business is magic. I killed in New York, and I killed in L.A., and after I saw the entire season of the show, I felt truly, deeply happy. Against the odds, it had all worked out. After days of nail-biting, Dan could finally take a breather because he'd successfully seen me through my commitments for the week. The poor guy was tired, so he went to get some well-deserved sleep in his hotel room. I told Dan that I was going to sleep too, but once I was alone, I changed my mind and decided to take in the night air. The next thing I knew, I was across town at a bar that I used to frequent, and I wasn't going there to drink. At this particular establishment, there are guys in the back who sell things that are quicker than liquor. This particular place is where I first bought blow in L.A. back in 1996. And as of last February, business is still booming because, let's face it, no one is going to win a war on drugs. When I got there, I recognized a bouncer that I'd met years ago, and he recognized me, and he gave the guys in the back a nod so they'd let me through the door, into the part of the bar I was interested in. Now, I knew it was a bad idea for me to be there at all, and an even worse idea for me to buy drugs. But I knew why I was doing it. I'm a junkie who abhors boredom. And as fucked up as it is, that self-knowledge comes with a deluded sense of freedom. Plus, things were going so well that I had a reason to celebrate. To commemorate an achievement, some people pop bottles of champagne with their friends. I snort drugs alone in my room. I couldn't resist, but I had my head on my shoulders. I planned to have just a little bit of fun without throwing it all into the blender the way I had with Sexy Southie. At the same time, just before I decided how much I was going to buy, I recalled something the famous producer Bernie Brillstein once said to me. And he'd told me that he'd said the same thing to both John Belushi and Chris Farley and often regretted saying it, even though it's true. He asked them, as he asked me, "What did you get into show business for? Was it not to fuck hookers and do drugs? Then you must want to be an accountant. I hear they're hiring." According to that philosophy, if you're in show business and not getting high and fucking a whore, then you're wasting your time. What an angle. It's a great one to use to fool yourself if you only have the one shot, like I did that night. I bought myself coke and heroin and fell way off the wagon. And to be honest, I fucking enjoyed it. I'm not trying to justify my actions, but I did learn something new this time, which is saying a lot because doing drugs is something I've done far too often to find them enlightening anymore. As a lot of people know, opioids cause constipation, which is a big problem for everyone who abuses them. Junkies talk about this all the time, and no one seems to have figured out a way around it. Well, on this bender, I solved the riddle. I learned that if you do cheap, stepped-on Mexican coke, you will not get constipated when you do heroin. It simply doesn't happen. I wish I had known this years ago when I was a practicing junkie full-time. It would have made life so much easier. If you do coke when you do heroin, you just speedball all your problems right out of your ass. Speaking of colon health, I've been enjoying one of the many TV ads aimed at 111-year-olds that Fox News airs every 2 minutes. If you weren't aware, humanity has taken another giant step forward, and we now have at-home colon cancer test technology. Thanks to the miracle of science and UPS, you no longer need to leave your house to give your doctor a stool sample. You can now take a shit in a box in the comfort of your own home and have UPS pick it up. It's amazing what our society is capable of, and the best part of it all is that the entire experience is brown. You put your brown in a box, and then Big Brown takes it away in a big brown truck, probably by a black guy, which, again, is more brown. The commercial is the funniest thing. It features a very pleasant, non-threatening black gentleman, about 68, wearing a powder blue V-neck sweater, sitting in his immaculate home, straight out of Better Homes and Gardens. The entire commercial is narrated by the animated box that you put your shit in if you use this service. The pleasant black guy is reading a magazine, but he is going to shit in the talking box. He goes in the bathroom, and the box says something like, "And I go with you. And you do your business in me." The box keeps narrating, smiling and talking as it walks out of the bathroom, now full of the guy's shit. The box is smiling after the guy literally just shit into its head. The box then walks itself to the curb and gets picked up by Big Brown. It's unbelievable. It's almost as weird as the commercial for toe fungus medication that Mario Lopez does. There is a giant toe with fungus on it wearing a top hat talking to Mario Lopez. If you ask me, the fungus and the box of shit need to get together. They need a sitcom, like the Brady Bunch. Here's the story of a toe with fungus who is best friends with a box that's full of shit. Fridays, after an all-new flimsy shine. Anyway, I got my drugs and had enough sense to get out of there before I got into even more trouble. I went to an all-night restaurant that I like to get some food and get high before I locked myself in my hotel room. And that is when this bender taught me another lesson. I not only discovered that you don't get constipated if you do coke while doing heroin, but also that you are able to eat if you do heroin while doing coke. It's all connected. This was a revelation. After I finished my meal, I went to pay at the register up front.